Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, August 22nd, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, where we analyze news media behavior from our perches at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at RJI and member of the Missouri School of Journalism faculty. Here with me are Views regulars and J-School colleagues, Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Our topics this week: U.S. Senate candidate Todd Akin is resisting pressure from the Missouri and national Republican establishments to drop out of the race against incumbent Democrat Claire McCaskill. How have journalists performed so far in the wake of Akin's controversial and scientifically inaccurate statement about rape and pregnancy? The GOP National Convention gets underway this weekend in Tampa, with the Democrats soon to follow. Normally, the party platforms are ignored by most reporters, but they're getting more scrutiny in light of Akin's abortion comments. Time Magazine and CNN, both owned by the same parent company, have accepted Fareed Zakaria's explanation for his recent plagiarism and have reinstated him in print and on air. Some wonder whether media companies can do the right thing when the offending star's personal brand rivals their own. And a new survey of Americans suggests that Republicans are largely responsible for another depressing decline in perceived news media credibility. Well, as we were taping this program earlier today, Congressman Todd Akin, who wants to replace Claire McCaskill in the U.S. Senate, had still remained defiant. Mitt Romney and every former GOP senator from Missouri in the past 25 years have called for him to get out of the race. But Akin says he's in it to win it. He blames liberal elites, including the media, for fanning the flames, and the Republican establishment for, quote, overreacting. Akin perhaps hopes this campaign ad makes up for his statement in a St. Louis TV interview over the weekend that victims of legitimate rape don't get pregnant and don't need an abortion because, quote, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
I'm Todd Akin, and I approve this message. Rape is an evil act. I used the wrong words in the wrong way, and for that I apologize. As the father of two daughters, I want tough justice for predators. I have a compassionate heart for the victims of sexual assault, and I pray for them. The fact is, rape can lead to pregnancy. The truth is, rape has many victims. The mistake I made was in the words I said, not in the heart I hold. I ask for your forgiveness.
Well, we could approach this story, of course, from so many angles. Let's leave the political prognostication to the countless others who are already engaged in it and focus, for the most part at least, on the media's performance and its responsibilities. And Lee, let's start with the science of this story. There have been various theories, as we know, if you're willing to go back centuries even, that have claimed that women can't or at least aren't very likely to get pregnant as a result of rape. Those theories, of course, don't hold up very well under scrutiny, and I'm just wondering whether you think journalists so far have done a good job of illuminating that fact.
I think journalists have done an average job of illuminating that fact. I think that there could be a lot more, hi, here's the study, here's where you find it, here's the link. And we really haven't seen, you know, that much. I mean, yes, there has been some. I also think that what journalists need to do, and this is something that we failed to do in the initial flurry, is Mr. Akin said that he had talked to physicians, that he had seen studies. So he wants to claim that he used the wrong words. I'm sorry, I don't believe it, in part because of the context in which the original words were used. And I think that we owe it to our readers, viewers, and listeners to go out and to see if we can locate the studies that he referred to find the physicians that he said to talk to them and get them on the record and to see what it is that they say.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, Charles. I mean, journalists really, I think, need to be kind of skeptical about his claim that he merely misspoke, right? He chose the wrong words because, as Lee suggests, you can dig pretty much deeper into anything he's written or said about the topic of abortion over the years and find that he really does believe some of the things that he said, maybe inartfully, and he's in fact introduced legislation over the years that puts those beliefs into practice.
Yes. In fact, he co-sponsored a bill with the current nominee for Vice President of the United States in the Republican Party, Mr. Ryan, and that will be, I guarantee you, the subject of a lot of journalism in the next few weeks. One of the stories that popped, I think overnight, was the Atlantic Monthly, I do believe, did a really excellent story about where the idea of legitimate rape may have come from, far-right pro-life circles. They traced it back to a physician that's closely aligned to the Family Research Council, I do believe, who came out yesterday backing Aiken and supporting what he said and saying what he said is true. So there are people who believe this. This is what I think maybe people have a hard time understanding, but there are people who buy into these completely unscientific, totally disproven, I won't even use the word theory, that's libeling the word theory, beliefs. And so there already has been a lot of journalism, and I think we've seen some excellent journalism just in a 24-hour cycle.
I noticed on the NewsHour last night there was a reporter who was talking about sort of the historical context of statements like this, and one of the things that she said is that ideas like this, I'm reluctant to call them theories, have actually, you can trace them back in American political culture to the early 1980s. And what it really is a way to try to get around the notion that if one is against abortion, perhaps one should be in favor of abortion in certain limited instances. And the two that come up most frequently are, of course, rape and incest.
It seems laughable on its face for Aiken to be blaming the liberal establishment or the liberal media for his troubles when practically every Republican, you know, who's running for anything is trying to get him out of the race. I do think there is something to be said for the fact that journalists need to give, you know, adequate treatment of the religious, moral, and ethical arguments about abortion, even people who believe that there should be no exemptions for it. But the science, I mean, I think we have to be very clear. Journalists don't owe anybody a break in fudging over what the real science is.
And I think that there's a difference between, and the Washington Post sort of tiptoed up to this yesterday and then backed away from it, a difference between giving people an honest forum for their points of view, no matter how much folks may disagree with them personally, and saying that this point of view is actually funded out of some other place. And what the Post wrote about yesterday was Aiken's religiosity. And please understand, I said religiosity, not faith, not religion. Those are three very different words, and they mean very different things. But the point of all of this being, and I think Aiken's apology actually reflects this, is that he believes that in many ways this is a faith-based. It's his particular religious view, and he believes that he's running on those principles, as which he said many times, and furthermore, that he's going to get elected on that stance. And that's tough for us to write about, but we really do need to put a little pressure on it.
Well, Charles, this controversy erupted, of course, over the weekend because of comments that Aiken made when he was being interviewed on a TV program, KTVI in St. Louis. Well, Charles Jaco, the journalist who conducted that interview, he's a good journalist. He's got a long career from NBC News and CNN before he took jobs in St. Louis. And he says, however, that he screwed up and dropped the ball, in his words, by not following up Aiken's abortion comment. Now, I watched the interview online, and it seemed to me that, you know, Jaco was kind of just pro forma about this. He said, I've interviewed Aiken so many times, and it looked like that comment just sort of went right over his head. Do you think that he was right in saying, you know, I should have followed up, I screwed up on this?
Well, he's right, but I don't think he needs to punish himself too harshly. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things happen. Yeah, he should have followed up. I mean, it would have been fabulous television, if nothing else, if he'd have said, wait, what? What did you say? It would have been a wonderful opportunity to explore further. And it also would have removed any doubt about this I misspoke thing, because Aiken could have elaborated on the belief system that led to this sort of sorcery in which, you know, women can repel rapists. And we would have had less he said, she said, sort of I didn't mean that, because he could have expounded on it. But that said, I don't know. I mean, sometimes people say outlandish things and you're almost taken aback from them. And instead of following, you kind of go, It takes a few seconds for that to sort of sink in.
That was my response to him saying that he messed up. And I'm going, well, no, you committed journalism. You got him to say this in the first place. Good on you. But I've been in the place where I've interviewed people who've said something that has so astonished me that that you're sort of not, you're just wordless, but you literally can't figure out, now where do I go with this? Yeah. And television makes it worse because you don't have much time to sit and breathe and try to, you know, let the silence help you out, which is, you know, a virtue for being a print reporter. Well, he didn't have that going for him in this case.
Well, let's talk about a print reporter who also admits screwing up on this story. His name is David Catanese. He works for Politico. And he decided after the comments came out to go to Twitter to raise some provocative questions. And he suggested that we should focus on what Aiken meant to say when he talked about legitimate rape, but that we probably won't do that. I mean, he argued, Catanese on Twitter said that, you know, it's political correctness, and so we're going to take him down no matter what. Well, Politico took him down, took him off that beat at least. He's not covering that story anymore. And now we see that he, too, is apologizing to his colleagues for giving offense. And I guess I wonder, Lee, what you make of that apology and that whole business about using Twitter to stir up people about this thing.
I'm sorry. Twitter should be illegal for journalists. It's very hard to say anything in the very few characters that you're allowed. I think this is one place where the need for speed has, in so many instances, overwhelmed anything that could be called good judgment, that we should just basically learn that lesson and stop.
I thought it was interesting. There's a piece we've got on our blog that's from Jeff Sonderman, who's writing on the Pointer blog, and he says that basically this reporter made three big mistakes, Charles, and I wonder if you'll agree that these were the ones that he made. One, he sided or was perceived as siding with the politician, at least for rhetorical purposes. He posed questions rather than actually answering them about what Aiken may or may not have meant, and that he missed the big picture. He was focusing on this business about legitimate rape as opposed to the business about you can't get pregnant from being raped.
Now, I think he made many other mistakes. Probably could name another three or four. One, he's a beat reporter trying to play pundit, stupid. He took a statement that is biologically, scientifically indefensible and tried to defend it, stupid. And he did so in the most public of forums, stupid, stupid, stupid. So I think what happened to him was richly deserved.
Well, it doesn't appear that he's going to receive any additional punishment other than, you know, having to publicly apologize and get taken off that beat. So we'll see how that plays out. Now, Monday night, Lee, another journalist, I guess we'll call him a journalist, Piers Morgan, the talk show host over on CNN, he was scheduled to interview Todd Aiken, as chance would have it. Well, Aiken canceled after the big dust-up, and he canceled at the last moment. So what did Morgan do? He turned the camera on an empty chair. And then he called the congressman, quote, a gutless little twerp for bailing out. What do you think about that?
Okay, we can lose the gutless little twerp comment if you really are a journalist. I suppose if you're a pundit, you're allowed that expression. But I do like the notion of the empty chair, in part because I think in the last decade or so, journalists have become really, really spineless about letting their audiences know that I asked this question and so-and-so, and I don't mean a so-and-so, I mean whoever your source is, refused to comment. I think that's information that people ought to have. I think you also put what Piers Morgan did together with the round of talk show interviews that Aiken made this morning, where he obviously felt that now he was going to try to get in front of the story. And now we can talk about, okay, how are journalists this morning being manipulated by a political source in a way that Morgan really reluctantly refused to be.
I guess I have to say the first time or two I saw television news use the empty chair trick, it was kind of compelling, but now it's kind of getting stale. A lot of people do it.
Couldn't they just use one of those holograms?
Maybe that's what CNN should do. Now, I think, Lee, you were the one who pointed it out, and I know, Charles, you've mentioned it too. It's not just Congressman Aiken who believes that there should be a ban on abortions, or at least federal support for abortions, even in the cases of rape and incest. In fact, the delegates at the Republican National Convention, the platform committee, has included that very language in the platform. And this led to a rather interesting cover image for the Huffington Post reporting on this yesterday. If you're watching our program as opposed to listening to it, you'll see it. Below the headline that says GOP platform, anti-abortion amendment, no rape exemption, the graphic they use is a line drawing of a very large wire hanger. What do you think of that? Is
that's
that going
stark.
Too far? Is that's, that just right?
Well, I mean, it's reality. It's fact-based reporting. To look at the platform. The platform is Aiken's position without the pseudoscience, right? If you take away the balderdash scientific claim of how women can and cannot get pregnant, you get back to the incest rape exemption. This platform categorically denies it. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, it's unfair to Aiken that he is taking all the arrows from his Republican brethren who, the day they were shooting those arrows at him, were endorsing this platform. And I think that does deserve a whole lot more journalistic discussion, and thankfully we'll have it.
But Lee, also talking about this specific image, okay, and this is in line with a lot of things we've seen lately on Newsweek covers and other magazine covers, sort of desperately trying to draw, well, I'll use the word desperately, trying to draw audience any way they can, ratcheting up sort of the sensational factor. Some would argue that the coat hanger is a pretty good metaphor image for this story, but others say it's either crossing the line or at the very least it's part of that manipulation to try to draw in, see the sort of search engine friendly viewers.
Well, I think it may be all those things, but I also think that to a generation of women, it will be meaningless. I am old enough that I remember what it was like to be a young woman before Roe v. Wade. When I was a college student, I had a close friend who almost died from an illegal abortion. And that's where the coat hanger thing actually comes from. The generation of students that we have now at MU have never known a culture where abortion wasn't possible, often difficult to obtain. And so I'm not sure how much that the coat hanger image conveys to people who aren't essentially my age. And I'm not sure that I'm the demographic they really want to attract.
Well, we've mentioned that the political conventions are almost upon us and that the GOP platform committee has approved this no exemption for rape or incest plank on abortion. So I guess I want to ask the question that we ask every 4 years. How much does this really matter? I mean, does anybody pay attention to the platforms these days? Do candidates really abide by them? Do these policy documents actually influence policy by government? You know, the conventional wisdom, at least, Charles, has been for a long time that these platforms, nobody cares. They don't follow them unless they want to. Journalists don't report on them. But now they are. Should we be paying more attention?
Well, Representative Aiken has cast a bright light on the party platforms, and they will be the subject of a lot of journalism. I mean, they're aspirational documents. Therefore, they're sort of, when they're as extreme as the GOP platform is this time around, given the fact that that's the aspirational document, not a realistic document, but an idealistic one, it becomes even more topical, I think, given what just happened. Now, in another year where Aiken had not said what Aiken said this weekend, you're right. They would be a dusty little document. Now, however, I would imagine reporters are going to pore over them. I saw something yesterday about the anti-Sharia law plank that they added. I mean, they've got a little chestnut in there for everyone. So there's going to be a lot of reporting.
It is truly. I mean, I remember Bob Dole way back in the day when he was a Republican nominee basically saying, I haven't read it and I probably won't have time to read it. And so, I mean, there is some sense that the candidates will do whatever they want with the platform. If it suits them to emphasize a particular plank, they will. And if not, they won't. But there is at least one scholar we cited in our blog today who basically says, hey, wait a minute. You know, these party platforms do matter in the sense that the party regulars, at least, and those include legislators. They include people who are part of big constituency groups, whether they're labor unions or corporations or whatever. They spend a lot of time drafting these things, and they try to get them turned into policy. So maybe we should be paying attention to
it. Well, I think we should be paying attention to the platform. I've always thought it was a little bit disingenuous of us to say, well, they won't really follow it, so we'll just ignore it. But I think what the platform means is, for journalists at least, is look at the public record, follow the public record. I mean, one of the stories that I have yet to see is any journalist gone and looked at the congressional record to find out the things that Representative Aiken has said on the floor of Congress regarding the bill that he and Congressman Ryan have co-sponsored? I mean, so to me, it's one more document that's worthy of scrutiny, but it's also a document that I think may have some clues that then do become worthy of reporting. And that, by the way, is for both sides, not just the Republicans, even though their convention is first this four-year term. So we're talking about them this week.
Well, and that was going to be my next point, Charles. I mean, whether we're talking about the nominating process, who gets to speak at the conventions, the party platform, or for that matter, increasingly, what gets governed and what doesn't in this country is determined by the extremes of both parties. So if those documents accurately represent whether those extremes, why shouldn't we say this is a primary focus of our reporting?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I think those documents, again, as aspirational, this is what we want the country to look like documents, they couldn't be much more of a contrast right now. I mean, really, because you've got a Democratic platform that will be wonkish, policy-driven, incredibly safe. They're not going toward any ideological issues.
They've got an incumbent who's trying to win a re-election.
And on the other side, you have a giant teabag, effectively. I mean, just a huge sop to the Tea Party wing of the party. So, yeah, one of the great stories of the conventions will be whether or not the Republicans can manage in this maelstrom to keep this uneasy alliance between the ideological extreme and the corporate middle. And right now it's, I think, hanging by a thread.
Well, and on the other side for the Democrats, I think it's going to be the same kind of maelstrom about can you run for the safe middle while only holding out minimal sops to what is often called the progressive or the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's all about negotiating with your base, I guess.
Well, you know, the same conventional wisdom about the platforms applies to the conventions themselves. And we see a lot of reporting over the years about those conventions. They don't really matter anymore. The nominees have been chosen, that they're only a day, you know, days long infomercial, or at best, maybe they're a tryout for up and comers in the party. Is it fair to say that maybe we spend too much time talking about the conventions because maybe we invest so much money in covering them?
I think it's fair to say it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You pour time and resources into it, therefore you have to pour coverage out of it. And so much of the process of the convention is now preordained. Well, all of it is preordained to the point at which the convention is just theater. And yeah, there's some merit in covering theater because out of the mouths of babes come the most amazing things, right? So you want to cover, you know, Donald Trump giving an address on day one because who knows what will come out of the man's mouth. You want to cover, likewise, you know, the Democratic convention because who knows? I mean, it's these unscripted moments.
Right.
The problem is there are so few unscripted moments now at a convention.
Well, I think that while there are few unscripted moments, I think we journalistically in some ways have allowed that to happen because we've allowed ourselves to be, you know, reconciled to our booths and, you know, floor passes and all of this other sort of stuff. And when I actually think that we could make things less unscripted, which actually might force us to do some actual reporting, and I think that would be good for everyone.
I do think it's interesting that those folks who defend the sort of wall-to-wall convention coverage will point out a couple of things. One, they still get big TV audiences despite the fact that they're just theater. And so I guess that matters that a lot of people are paying attention. There's even some research that's being quoted this year that suggests that there are actually large numbers of voters who haven't made up their minds and often do make them up by listening to the speeches either at the conventions or in the debates. And so, I mean, we do obviously need to cover them, but I'm just really skeptical about whether we will cover them any better this year than we have in the past. Well, we have just a few minutes. I want to cover a couple of other quick topics. Fareed Zakaria, we talked about it last week. He's back in the pages of Time magazine. He's on the air at CNN again. The Time Warner-owned media companies have reinstated him, and they did it after they accepted his explanation and his apology, both for plagiarizing a passage from another magazine in a column he was writing recently about gun control. Well, it's kind of interesting because Zakaria Lee's, he's known far and wide. He writes columns, he writes books, he's on TV, but he also gets invited to a lot of dinner parties and makes a lot of speeches for the politically and economically powerful. And I just wonder about this argument now that maybe there are some brands, including these personal media brands like his, that are just too big to fail or too big to punish.
I don't know. I mean, I do think that what he did was at least as egregious in a different way as what Jonah Lehrer did. And it seems like right now Jonah Lehrer is paying a much higher price, both financially and professionally. I do think, I mean, it's always kind of been this way. You know, Bob Woodward, because of the circles that he circulates in, is the person who doesn't have to source his books in the same way that other people do. So Zakaria, in some ways, is hardly the first person to sort of benefit from the "I'm the insider and you're not" kind of approach to journalism ethics.
Too big to fail?
What I like about Fareed is his response, which is I'm going to slow it down, I'm going to start doing less, and I'm going to do less better, which is what I was really hoping his response would be. I mean, we talked about this earlier, and I think it's one of the downfalls of the current media economy, in which if you're going to be a star at that level, you have to do so much so fast that those sorts of things are a great risk.
You know, I think he's a great thought leader, a great columnist and journalist, but I'm a little less sympathetic with his, oh, I'm just so busy and there's so many demands on my time when I'm giving $75,000 a pop speeches than I am for the ordinary journalist these days, that because of the declines in the media economy, the internet, sure, they yep. have a lot more to do with a lot less time and resources to do it.
And they're paid a lot sure. less.
Yeah, well, that's for sure. The Stephen Brill, so many of us know, he's a longtime business journalist, publisher, entrepreneur. He said he wasn't satisfied, Charles, with Zakaria's explanation, but he's even less satisfied with the fact that journalists seem to just not dig into the details. Just even if he has a good excuse, they kind of let him off the hook without asking about deep questions about, well, did you use researchers and rely on them, or did you think it really was okay to borrow in the way that you borrowed? Fair criticism?
I mean, I think those questions are really interesting and should be asked. I also think, though, that the Fareed Zakarias of the world set the standard for journalists further down the food chain, and journalists further down the food chain look up and go, I want to be that. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is there's this massive speed up in personal branding, I think up and down, yeah. all the way to our students,
yeah.
where right. you get people that think that success equals clicks, right?
Yeah, we only have a couple of minutes left, and our last story this week, unfortunately, is an unsurprising continuation of a trend over the past decade or so. The Pew Research Center for the People and the Press has come out with its every other year survey of American attitudes toward the news media, and it shows, no surprise, historic lows in perceived credibility. Just to give you an idea, you could score media credibility on a scale of 1 to 4. 1 or 2 means you don't think very much of it. 3 or 4, they're pretty believable. Well, only 56% of Americans give a positive score to the media, whereas almost 3 out of 4 did just 10 years ago. So, I mean, there are lots of reasons for that, but I'll ask you, Lee, what do you think might be the primary reason why, either at the sort of the overall global level or for a lot of specific media brands, the numbers just keep going down?
I think it's because we have, especially in the broadcast media, become so tightly niched. People who are regular listeners of this program will know, in no uncertain terms, I find Fox News incredible. So if you ask me about Fox, I wouldn't score them very well. So I think in some ways, it's like if, when you say media, that term is not very meaningful anymore, because there are many mediums. The audience is very tightly niched. We tend to believe what we want to believe. That doesn't say very good things about us, but I think there's a lot of that going on.
And the biggest drop off, Charles, is among Republicans, who now say that only their local TV news and Fox News are the believable or credible channels in their minds, and they're really driving the numbers down for everybody else.
Sure. I mean, we've left the period of mass media, and now we're in the period of ideologically driven cable media that reflects that. I think the local newspaper, by the way, took a huge hit across these rankings, and I think that at least is in part because it is in many communities the institution that is tackling the really tough controversial subjects that make people angry.
And nobody's ratings went up, by the way, when they measured several different organizations. There's obviously something here as well, just about the general erosion in trusted institutions. Generally, we've mentioned that before. I'm sure we'll mention it again, but that's where we're going to have to wrap up this week's program. Lee and Charles, thanks as always for your analysis. Also, thanks to our technical team, Director Travis McMillan with the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and audio engineer Pat Akers from KBIA. We invite you to check our related stories as well as audio and video of the show. It's on our Views page. Go to the Talk Show tab at kbia.org. You can also leave us comments, questions, or suggestions there, or if you prefer, send them by email to views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of Views of the News.